Welcome. How are you doing?
Good morning. One, a good morning from the East Coast of the United States to all of you who are listening. And, you know, unfortunately that we have to be starting the second anniversary of the invasion of Ukraine, which I have to commend Miria Report for being on air almost nonstop for 2 years at the same time. So I'm very pleased to be here and to speak on this relatively august occasion.
True. Malcolm, thank you very much for joining us. We evidently, you know what happens when you arrive 30 minutes later and the office is a mess, right? I'm so glad that you're here. No, thank you for joining us. It's very important that we put things into perspective. We have Professor Rajan Menon coming up also in a few minutes. He was fighting with some technical difficulties at the moment. I hope that we'll have him in a few minutes. But very, very briefly, let's highlight one thing. The Ukrainian resilience, the national resilience you've experienced on site with your comrades and also with the International Legion, you've seen how people act, you've seen how they integrate their capabilities. At the moment, they are really heavily tested for lack of ammunition. And whilst the Czech president has a great agenda and a good proposal, and I commend him, and I think everybody does, for the initiative and the intensity with which he pushes it forward, it's hard. And the stocks for ammunition are there, both excess defense articles as well as those which could be delivered, maybe still under the very small remainder of the PDA, as well as what bloody hell Congress doing on the other hand. They get 800,000 artillery shells from whatever the Czechs have identified. If we can find people to do it quickly and finance it, great. But that tides them over to a point. Europeans can or cannot produce enough later in the year. We will see. But God bless America. You have it. Why don't you give it?
Well, the politics of this are quite difficult, but first let me talk about the Ukrainian army and the guys who are still in the fight. As you know, I was in the Ukrainian army for 10 months. I spent my first 3 months with Defense Intelligence, Ministry of Defense Intelligence, or KHUR, and then I went to 1st Battalion, International Legion. KHUR actually runs its own legion. We refer to it as the Secret Legion. It's a paramilitary program made up of small squads of legionnaires that's actually based on a PowerPoint that I had sent to the Deputy Minister of Defense about 3 days after the invasion, where they were planning to form the International Legion. And I managed to get an audience with her. And later on, KHUR created these 12 to 20 man paramilitary teams that were supposed to operate very light and fast with pickup trucks. But it actually became the template later for all of their paramilitary intelligence supporting teams, and then 3rd Battalion Legion, which is the Special Operations Battalion. So I went from KHUR to 1st Battalion Legion, which was the infantry battalion. We were in fixed positions in Kharkiv province until the counter offensive in September. And then I went to 3rd Battalion International Legion, which is the Special Operations Battalion for the Kharkiv counteroffensive. So it was a very different time in Ukraine. Things were quite desperate the first few months. Ammunition was a very, very big problem, because the Ukrainians were firing principally 122-millimeter and 152-millimeter artillery shells from Soviet-era weapon systems. And the Russians at the time had a 10-to-1 overmatch on artillery, and in some places, much greater than 10-to-1. But Ukraine's own resilience, their ability to rapidly counterattack and kill three separate Russian armies, the one north of Kyiv, the one northeast of Kyiv, and then the one out between Sumy and Kharkiv, and push all of them back, is nothing more than a miracle. And it's really a testament to the guts that the Ukrainians have. And I'm very proud that I could help You know, in whatever way that I did, my battalion is still on the line. We're still in. We've rotated all around. They've been to Bakhmut. They've been to various other places, and then now we're back in Kharkiv province because there's a big Russian buildup in the direction of Kupiansk. And you know, I've spent the last year since I've left just doing what we're doing here at Myriad Report, which is fundraising, helping out with awareness of what's going on with Ukraine. I was honored to be called by the White House to come and give my opinions on on Ukraine's needs to the National Security Council. And in fact, I emphasized that the Ukrainians needed to shift to becoming a night force like the United States. So they seriously are considering, you know, hundreds of thousands of pieces of night vision, which would give Ukraine a much deeper capability. But so long as the politics of what's happening are impacting us all, it's really artillery, which, as we know, is queen of the battlefield. And, you know, Ukraine had, you know, our experience in Ukraine showed that the estimates the United States thought that they would need for a full-scale war with Russia or China was 10 times less than what they had planned at the maximum. So, you know, in this relatively narrow battlefield that's 1,000 kilometers long in eastern Ukraine, if it had not been for this war, you know, which, you know, we didn't want, it was, you know, a Russian invasion, some very hard lessons are being learned from the West. And this is why the politics in the United States are, you know, are really impacting the battlefield. For those of you who don't know, I know Myriad Report tries to be as nonpartisan as possible, but I've written four New York Times bestsellers on the Trump administration and their ties to Russian intelligence, starting with my sixth book, The Plot to Hack America. Then the plot to destroy democracy, which was really all about Russian intelligence operations to buy conservative movements throughout Europe, very highly successful. The inroads that they made into the alt-right in the United States and evangelicals and the Republican Party. I mean, they literally sent agents, Maria Butina and others, to influence the National Rifle Association. This Russian FSB spy got to be the first person to give the first question to Donald Trump on foreign policy. And now we're finding that the Republican Party is almost a wholly owned subsidiary of Russian intelligence in terms of the you know, the investigations they were carrying out. And there's only one explanation for why this is happening. That's because Donald Trump has been enthralled with Russia as far back, Russia in Eastern Europe, as far back as 1977, when he met his first wife, Ivana. And then from 1977 to 1988, her father, Ivana Trump's father, was the reporting entity about Donald Trump and all of his activities to Czech intelligence, the STB, which passed everything on to the KGB dutifully. So they knew Donald Trump wanted to visit Russia in 1988, 6 months before anyone in the United States did, because Ivana had been speaking to her father about it. Her father recorded all the calls, passed it on to the Czech intelligence, and the KGB knew about it. And they wined and dined Donald Trump. And Trump has always had this affinity towards Moscow that culminated in 2014 when he was given Miss Universe in Moscow and was being promised that he would build a billion-dollar Trump Tower in Moscow with its luxury spa called the Ivanka Spa. And he thought he could play Vladimir Putin by offering him a $100 million condo at the top, not knowing that this man had been watching him, you know, had the KGB files on him and knew that he was a fool that could be manipulated. But Trump is in love with Russia. And so everything you see is from his second impeachment, his attempt to extort Zelensky, with the very Javelin missiles that saved Ukraine. That $400 million of defense aid that he said that he was trying to withhold were the 1,000-plus Javelin missiles that they were only allowed to use defensively. And that saved the country. So that's how we got where we are. The Republican Party will do whatever Donald Trump says. Donald Trump is working on behalf of Moscow. He, with all his talk about, you know, I just make one phone call and this war would be over, is ludicrous. You know, he praised Putin when Putin invaded Ukraine in 2014 as a strong leader who's showing an iron will, and he publicly insulted President Obama at that time. So that's why we are where we are. That's the politics of it. And so long as Donald Trump says Ukraine gets nothing, the Republican Party will give Ukraine nothing.
Well, I wouldn't stretch it on everyone in the Republican Party, Malcolm, but currently you are quite right to highlight, of course, that there's a stranglehold by what I would call a very visceral, polarized, isolationist, at times rather narcissistic wing of it. But nevertheless, the result is that currently we're stuck with that speaker and we're stuck with these politics. Now, having said this, at the same time, by the way, if I may just highlight, the three warships which were not turned around to have a little look-see at Sevastopol at that point in time were under the guidance of the then president. It seems that there's a continuity in failing to act. But you're absolutely right about, and I completely agree with you, that the man is enthralled with Russia. But the leading thought should always be nobody plays the Tsar. Absolutely nobody plays the Tsar. We've just seen yet again evidence that he really doesn't care about anyone anyway.
Right. Well, you're absolutely right about that. But, you know, there's a deeper dynamic. And let me talk about the Republican Party. There are only 16 Republicans that now presently are expressing any interest towards supporting Ukraine. And most of them, with a couple exception of a couple of, national security hardliners, are people who won in Biden districts. And they are mortified that if they don't fund Ukraine, they will lose in those Biden districts in 2024. And that's probably true. They're going to lose anyway. And when you consider it, the House is now hanging by a hair. When they seat the congressman that just defeated George Santos, they will have a plus one majority in there. But, you know, we have Democrats who are now, you know, in anti-government themselves. We have the pro-Palestinian caucus. There's, you know, the squad. That's five Democrats that cannot be relied on at all to help Ukraine, because they view funding Ukraine as, you know, being anti-Palestinian. So but the Democrats can pass this, you know, legislation. The minority leader has made it eminently clear that he has the technique and to bring the bill up onto the floor, and that it would pass with an overwhelming, 95% of Democrats, plus those 16 Republicans who are in Biden districts. But Donald Trump has made it eminently clear to all Republicans, you vote for this, you're done. You will be put out of the party. And these people also fear for their lives. Let's just be honest. So, you know, like I said, I've written hundreds of thousands of words on this crazy phenomena, where, you know, if whatever Trump says, that's what goes. And so any Republican that does vote for this, even if it's three or four of them, or five, which I think is what they need, and this passes, the wrath of Trump is going to fall down on top of them. They may as well just switch parties.
Well, we will see. It seems that there might be a lot more roll call, and others are reporting that there may be a significantly larger amount of Republicans saying this is enough, this is in our national security interest. We'll have to see, but the discharge petition will have to be decisive in that regard.